courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUS Kids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Coming up on Heard on the Street, the biggest threat to home builders may be coming from Washington, and why the coming IPO from Altice USA is fraught with risk.
Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Hello and welcome to Heard on the Street, the podcast. We are the Wall Street Journal's home for commentary on all things financial all over the world. Reporting from New York, I'm Miriam Gottfried, joined by my colleague Alex Frangos in London. Hi, Alex.
Hey, Miriam.
So in our second segment, we'll talk about why the so-called Altice way could mean big risks for investors in the pending IPO of the cable company's U.S. subsidiary. But first, we have Heard on the Street's Justin Lehart here to talk to us about how the Trump administration's policies are affecting home builders. Hi, Justin.
Hi.
So shares of home builders have been doing pretty well since the election of President Trump. Why are you arguing that now his policies pose the biggest threat to that rally?
I mean, the problem that home builders are having right now is a cost problem. So the labor market is tight, especially in construction, right? A lot of people don't want to go into construction because the last time people were in construction, they got really hammered, right?
So we have a president who's the construction expert.
That's true.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there are two things going on right now. First thing is we have this trade dispute with Canada, which is sort of a long running thing that got resurfaced.
What really happened there? I mean, I thought we were friends with Canada.
We're friends. Yeah.
Friends can have differences.
This is a long running difference on lumber imports from Canada, which account for a ton of the lumber that we use in the United States, like more than a quarter for framing. So there's this dispute, and the U.S. is going to impose tariffs.
Yeah, 20% tariff, right?
Yeah, and we've already seen, even before it got announced, we saw lumber prices were running up because of, in expectation of this. So that matters. That matters for home builders. It's a big chunk of home builder costs. Like, just lumber alone accounts for like 9% of costs. So you jack that up, and you're jacking up the price of building the home. Now, another thing that's happening is we've had this really much more strident enforcement of immigration. And one of the places where illegal immigrants work the most is in the construction industry. So it accounts for, according to Pew Research, they account for about 15% of the construction industry labor force.
Big national publicly listed home builders can't possibly be using illegal labor. I mean, is that who this is targeting, or is this smaller home builders?
Well, it's not targeting any. It's targeting illegal immigrant and illegal or unauthorized, immigrants. And, first thing, everybody uses subcontractors. So, I'm sure that anybody that you talk to will say that they don't use any illegal workers, that everyone's on the up and up, that everyone's e-verified and so forth. And, for a lot of people, that's probably true, right? But we're talking about an absolute labor pool. So you shrink the labor pool, right? It doesn't matter. Like, if you're a builder who only used e-verified or, people who are allowed to work here, and I'm a builder who doesn't, and I lose my workers, or there's this chill, my workers are scared to come work, well, then we're all of a sudden competing for a smaller pool of workers. And that's going to make your prices, that's going to make your labor costs go up.
So even if you've really been hard-lined about only hiring workers that are legally allowed to work in the U.S., this affects you.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And there are other things going on, too. So those are two cost issues. And they're already having labor costs anyhow, labor problems anyhow, because it's a tight labor market, right? At the same time, costs for other things are going up. We've heard from a number of building supply companies that are saying that they've been raising prices, and their price increases are going through, right? And then we have the other thing coming from Washington is the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve is raising rates, and they're getting ready to start running off their treasuries and mortgage securities.
So that could create a problem on the demand side.
Well, what that could do is that could raise rates. So if your rates are higher, this is something that would happen sort of at the end of the year. But, you know, if your rates are higher, then the trade-off between renting and owning, right, changes, right? At a higher rate, you just can't afford as much house.
This all sounds terrible, Justin, for if I own home builder stocks, right? So, you know, what have investors internalized this, and or it sounds like they haven't. I mean, stocks have
done
really
well. I don't think so. They're pretty happy. If you take a look at the performance of home builders, I think there's still a lot of excitement about tax cuts and, you know, all this type of stuff.
And this may be something of a looming problem because interest rates are still pretty low now if you want to go out and get a mortgage today. But this is something that could be happening in future quarters.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens, you know, as we get into sort of the prime building season, what the labor supply issues are going to look like. You know, and they're in, I think, you know, you would have to, you know, put some differences between different home builders. So home builders that cater to really rich people like Toll Brothers, right? Rich people are a lot more price insensitive. So you have costs go up, you raise prices, you're going to be a little bit better off, right? Right. Other home builders that cater to more of the hoi polloi, I guess, they're probably going to have a harder time.
And that's every other home builder?
That's not every other home builder, but, you know,
some
home builders. So the really big ones are people that are, you know, operating in lots of areas.
So Justin, I mean, one bull case here for the home builders has been that home ownership has fallen to kind of historic lows, and young people have not wanted to buy homes, but now they're starting to edge back into the market. We read, you know, this week in the Wall Street Journal that home buying for, you know, from first time home buyers is edging up, and young people, millennials, are, you know, starting to consider buying a home. That sounds like a pretty powerful demographic force that could, you know, really, you know, maybe wash away some of these issues about, you know, costs and labor costs and material costs.
Yeah, I suppose so. Right. I mean, there's first thing, you have to have the income and the willingness, and you have to be able to get the loan. Right. I mean, just because you want to buy a house doesn't mean that you get to buy a house. Right. So that's sort of the situation still. You know, I guess, I mean, we've been sort of saying, oh, yeah, there's this sort of looming demand for housing. We've been saying it for a while now.
Is that what has driven up home builder prices so far?
I think a lot of what's driven up sort of the new home costs, and this is sort of a separate thing, is, you know, there really aren't as many home, there's just not that much supply of new homes. And part of that is because so many mom and pop builders just got taken out during the crisis, right? So limited supply has helped push up prices. And that's another, you know, that's why, you know, if these sort of polls of home builders, they're all super happy. And you're like, why are you so happy? The economy doesn't look like that good. And new home sales don't look that good. And you're like, oh, yeah, well, there's a lot fewer of them. Right. Of course they're happy.
So that's like another factor working in the other direction. Perhaps.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We are going to have to take a quick break. Coming up, why investors should beware of Altice USA's coming IPO.
Courage. I learned it from my adoptive mom.
Hold my hand.
You hold my hand.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care at AdoptUSKids.org. You can't imagine the reward. Brought to you by AdoptUSKids, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and the Ad Council.
Follow the Wall Street Journal on your favorite podcast app. Search WSJ on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and any Amazon Alexa device. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.
Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
Welcome back to Heard on the Street, the podcast. I'm Miriam Gottfried, here with Alex Frangos and our colleague Stephen Wilmot, who joins us from London. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Miriam.
So, Stephen, you wrote about the upcoming IPO of Altice USA, and that's the Amsterdam... Altice is the Amsterdam-listed company that bought Cablevision and Suddenlink here in the U.S. What makes it so risky to be a minority shareholder in an Altice subsidiary?
Well, yeah, you might think that Altice USA is a great prospect, and trading certainly seems to be very strong. In fact, today they announced first quarter results, and trading remains good in the US. And obviously, that's typically the focus when you look at IPOs. So that's got a lot of attention. What people might not be focusing on is the shareholding structure of the group, and basically. Altice USA is currently owned by some private equity companies, but mainly by Altice NV, which is his Amsterdam listed company, which is also obviously listed. And they own almost 60%. And so the IPO is just the minority private equity holders selling a bit of their stock. So there's actually no money being raised.
But this sounds great. Like, buy into a highly performing cable asset in the U.S. Everyone knows Cablevision, who's grew up in the Northeast. It's doing really well. They're cutting costs. Cash flow is doing great.
Yeah.
And you haven't been able to buy into this wonderful story, and now Altice is going to bestow on American investors the opportunity to own a piece of this action.
Yeah, and the problem basically is if you look at. SFR, which is in a similar situation in a way, in that it's a majority of it is owned by Altice NV, this Amsterdam listed company, and a minority is listed on the French stock exchange. There was a Altice NV, the parent company, tried to buy out the minorities in SFR last year, and the pricing was controversial at the time, and it eventually got sort of kicked into the long grass by the stock exchange regulator, the financial markets regulator. But in a way, that is less the issue, as I see it. I mean, the issue, as I see it, is mainly about a management fee that they said they might be introducing at SFR, and a management fee of roughly 2-3% of sales.
So SFR would have to pay Altice?
Yeah,
2-3% of sales?
SFR would have to pay Altice, so its parent company. Now, obviously, if this were a wholly owned subsidiary, it wouldn't really matter to investors how they kind of pushed cash around the group. It matters to the tax man, because often these things are sort of tax dodges, but it doesn't really matter to investors in the parent company. But if you're a minority investor in SFR, or indeed Altice USA, it matters a lot, how these fees are used to transfer cash between subsidiaries and the parent company. And so obviously, that raises the question, could there be a similar plan for the US?
It's looking at a pattern of behavior. How does Altice treat minorities?
And its justification for this 2-3% management fee at SFR was implementation of what it calls the Altice way, which is more basically a way of saying their business model, their operating strategy,
which is cutting costs, right?
Well, yeah, which is cutting costs, and they sort of talk about all sorts of other sort of more operational things, but that certainly for investors, the Altice way stands for leveraging up and cutting costs.
But this is something that other telecoms don't really do. They don't charge their subsidiaries for.
Yeah, I look quite closely into this, and you do get obviously transfers between subsidiaries and parent companies. There are license fees for brand licensing, for example. If you've got a strong brand like Orange in Europe, that's the biggest French telco. The Altice does not have a brand that it is a sort of major brand, so that shouldn't really be a question. And then certain head office services can be billed to subsidiaries on a kind of conventional transfer pricing arrangement. What doesn't seem to be in any way normal, and it's quite hard to understand why it would be normal, is charging a subsidiary for management, basically for a management model. The Altice way, and in fact they say that's not the plan in the US. So mindful that they're in an IPO process, the company's, they told me, oh no, we have no plans to introduce a management fee on the level of the SFR 2-3% of sales in the US. They do have a $30 million management fee, which was agreed with the private equity owners.
So there is a management fee. It's not that there is no management fee. It's just not on the side, on the level of the SFR management fee.
It works out at 0.33% of sales.
Basically, you could have this situation, down the road where Altice NV in Europe, which is going to own most of Altice USA, they need some cash. And they're like, well, our European business isn't doing so well. U.S. is going gangbusters. Why don't we just raise the fee? Because the Altice way is clearly working so well.
Yeah,
there,
exactly.
Need to be paid more for the Altice way.
You can't do without the Altice way.
Yeah, it's like we're implementing the Altice way in the U.S. now. So, we're gonna up the charges. I mean, they're not saying that's going to happen. But, but if you look at what they've done elsewhere in the group, that's exactly what's happened. So, that is, as far as I see it, is the risk buying into this, and it's obviously not one that it's easy to be distracted by great trading, but shareholders always have to understand the structures within which they're investing, and they would basically be minorities alongside this parent company, which has a history of treating sort of slightly steamrolling over minority rights.
It seems like in many companies, minority shareholders are relatively protected because their interests are aligned with the majority shareholders. But here you're talking about a place in which they're not precisely aligned because there are these fees that that the majority benefits from and the minority has to pay effectively.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think it's fair to say you want to be as close, but ultimately Altice is controlled by Patrick Drahi, often described as Moroccan-born but Franco-Israeli entrepreneur, basically. So it's very, and he's made a lot of money for investors. I should say that SFR shares since their IPO in 2013 have done very well, very volatile, but they've outperformed the market, which is, and this cost-cutting kind of track record has earned Mr. Drahi lots of fans on Wall Street and the City of London. But you want to be as close to Mr. Drahi's own investment vehicle in a way as you can, because it makes more sense to be, if you're going to invest in this story, you want to be investing in Altice NV, the Amsterdam company, not Altice USA. Admittedly, you don't necessarily want exposure to European telcos at the moment. I mean, the cables in the US are doing much better than.
Well, theoretically, you could buy NV and then short SFR and its other listed, then you get your US exposure, but closer to where the money is. But one thing you had in your piece that I thought was interesting about Drahi was this, just his overall model and the way he kind of operates, much more like a private equity owner than a public company owner, and that this kind of fee structure, the debt,
So he's often compared to a private equity owner because of the debt and the focus on cash flows, which obviously allows the debt, finances the debt. But another way in which is close to private equity is the use of fees. In private equity, they're levied on net asset value. Which is controversial too, but levying it on sales, I would say, is a step more dubious in a way, because you're incentivizing SFR to go for sales rather than profits, which isn't really coherent with the Altice way as we understand it, cutting costs, boosting cash flows. So there's a sort of complete, it doesn't seem to have been thought through for the benefit of minority shareholders, should we put it that way.
We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, more on why investors shouldn't pay too much for the Altice way.
Follow the Wall Street Journal on your favorite podcast app. Search WSJ on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Google Play Music, Stitcher, and any Amazon Alexa device. The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously. Stay ahead of the headlines. Stay on top of the markets. This is Heard on the Street from the Wall Street Journal.
So, Stephen, one thing we haven't talked about is the risk, the operational risk for Altice USA. we've talked about how the Altice way involves cutting costs, but here in the U.S., cutting costs hasn't historically led to growth for cable companies, especially when Optimum Cablevision has Fios as a direct competitor throughout much of its footprint. So what would you say is the bigger risk for Altice USA shareholders? Would it be rising management fees or the operational risks?
Well, you're clearly right to point to, you know, the risks that come with cost cutting. Obviously, you can say there's a short term gain in margins, and then followed potentially by an erosion of value as, you know, if marketing's cut or whatever, you know, loss of subscribers. That doesn't seem to have been the problem yet at Altice USA. I mean, you're more expert on the operational side than me, I would say, but from what I understand, they're investing quite heavily.
So not really cutting costs, but maybe reallocating resources.
Yeah, they, from what I understand, they've cut operating costs and expanded CapEx quite significantly to finance kind of faster broadband speeds, and therefore get, that's definitely the story they
investment
they
give anyway. Of that kind does seem to be necessary to compete here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, cable these days is nothing to do with TV, right? It's all about super fast broadband and being able to kind of support the you know, the voracious appetite of consumers for data downloads. So that's a very, very investment heavy proposition. So,
and you always have to worry just before an IPO that a company has kind of made things look as absolutely good as they can.
Absolutely.
You know, so that things are going great in the U.S. right now, right before the IPO.
Exactly.
Know, what's around the corner? You gotta be a little bit careful.
So that's still a risk.
And I would also point out, I mean, just to go back to the management fee point, because the story is developed today, because we've talked about the parent company being Altice NV, but actually Patrick Dry controls a company called Next, which owns 59% of Altice NV. So, you know, the problem in a way with this company is that as an investor, you can't be fully aligned with Patrick Dry, because you can, you know, the highest level of shareholding you can buy into is Altice NV,
which is still a minority stake.
But it's still a minority stake, and he actually signed a deal with management of Altice, the parent company, last November, to impose management fees on Altice NV, which would go to Next, which no one can invest in. And they've just today announced that they've actually stepped away from that arrangement. It's obviously been controversial enough with shareholders, in favour of a slightly more conventional kind of stock option kind of based plan.
This sounds like the back of my TV and all the cords that are twisting tied in there.
For sure.
Yes. We are going to have to end it there. That wraps things up for this week's Heard on the Street podcast. Please join us every week for the latest in global investing. For more, please check us out at wsj.com/heard. That's wsj.com/heard. You can also email us with your comments, suggestions, or questions at heardpodcast@wsj.com. From New York, I'm Miriam Gottfried. On behalf of the rest of the Heard on the Street team, thanks for listening.
The Wall Street Journal. Listen ambitiously.